This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, From the Deep, Mystery, Suspense and Sea Monsters in Historical Fantasy. And this week, we are delighted to have as our guest Ellis Johnson, who is the author of several books, but most notably for me, a couple of, well, historical mystery fantasy novels, which I've really enjoyed. Hi, Ellis.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we're really pleased to have you on with us today. So why don't you give us a little bit of an insight into the kind of things that you write?
Well, I write speculative fiction. I would say I write weird fiction and dark fantasy. Everything I write, even if I try to make it happy, somehow ends up with a dark element in it.
You know that feeling.
Yeah.
And are you writing multiple series or individuals? What kind of projects have you got at the moment?
Well, the novellas that Jules is talking about, they were originally planned as a duology. Don't know yet if they'll actually go into a series or not. I have two more books possible there. But to a certain extent, when you're self-publishing, it's also about what sells, what does well enough to kind of earn its keep in the writing lineup. Yeah. I have a much larger novel project that would be a series, but again, it's trying to evaluate where's my best time usage at the moment. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, tell our listeners a little bit about Harkworth Hall, which is how I became introduced to your work.
Well, Harkworth Hall is a queer gothic romance. The main character is Carolyn Daniels. She's an impoverished gentleman's daughter. And even though she prefers women, she is faced with the classic situation of having to marry for money. But as the story progresses, she finds that her suitor is not quite who he seems, and neither is his much more attractive secretary. So the deeper they get into the mystery, the darker, more murderous it becomes, and there's even a possible sea monster in the mix.
I found when I was reading it that there was a moment where it strongly reminded me of the story of Bluebeard.
Yes, I hadn't thought of Bluebeard at first, but this project actually began as a rewriting of The Robber Bride. It was just an exercise for me. I had never written a novella length before. I had written either very long or a lot of novelettes, but novella was not a length I had hit. So I set myself the task of kind of using this fairy tale structure to attempt something in like the 20,000 word length. And then, of course, because it's me, it doubled in size. But The Robber Bride was the first sort of structure I had in my head when I started writing.
Yeah, that's Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, but there's also a fairy tale that she was basing it on, too, of
a
woman who goes and discovers that her suitor is not all she thought he was.
No, have
and
you
there's
ever read
bodies.
That? Have you read that actual fairy tale, The Robber Bridegroom? It's utterly disgusting. It's so grim.
Yes.
Sounds exactly up your line, street.
Exactly.
Yeah, it does. Harkworth Hall is, I suppose I went into it originally because I obviously frequent NetGalley, which will come as no surprise to our listeners, because I'm always on the look for things to read. And I found it on there, and I was sort of expecting, I suppose, something a bit more traditionally bodice-rippy, I suppose.
Right.
So it's kind of like, I'm going for something that's a bit different. It looks good. I'll give it a go. And I rarely read blurbs as well. I tend to just go off the first couple of lines of the blurb and go from there. And I like to go in blind. And I was like so amazingly, pleasantly surprised at how different this was. And it had this really, really sweet romance at its heart as well. It was just so adorable.
Thank you. Did want to... You know, I also started writing this after the elections here in 2016, and it felt very emotionally important to write a happily ever after for myself, if nothing else. I needed something sweet in my life at that moment. So,
Yeah, definitely. I can get behind that. And the premise sounds fantastic, actually.
And there is a second. I was going to say, there is a second one, isn't there?
Yes, yes. And so the sequel, Leviathan, you know, as I said, it was kind of planned as a duology. You know, once Harkworth started to take shape, the sequel, Leviathan, just came out on June 15th. And so at the end of Harkworth, Carolyn and Joe have a mandate to investigate the younger brother of her suitor. And so Leviathan fulfills that mandate. Yes. With more sea monsters and bodies. Because why not?
It's the sea monsters. It's you've got a lesbian couple, mm-hmm. and then sea monsters,
yes.
and murder, yep. like all those things. That's it. That's it for me. I'm ticking all the right boxes. Fantastic.
Yeah,
and you've mentioned other projects. Can you tell us a little bit about your longer project that you're working on at the moment?
So I had quit writing for several years, and this novel series was what brought me back to writing. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I don't really have like an elevator pitch worked out for it, but it's historical again. It's vampires and alchemy, but it's also for me about faith, blind mm-hmm. faith, thoughtful faith. It's set in the 18th century. I have this thing about the Enlightenment and the ways that it worked or didn't work and how it's still impacting us today. So the series for me looks at faith versus reason and also empire building. That kind of lust for power, I've never understood it. Mm-hmm. And I started writing these books in part to try to understand it. What makes people who have enough want so much more in the world. So the first book is done. The second book is in good shape. And there's two more planned after that. And then they also correspond to the four stages of the alchemical magnum opus. So Negredo, Albedo, I always forget the yellow one, and then Rubedo is the finish. So
fantastic. That
sounds brilliant.
Yeah. A lot of work, though.
I bet, yeah. That's really, really cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, depending on how things go, maybe the first book next year will be out. I'm also just trying to plan launch times and how that works and estimate the writing time for the last two and so on. So a lot of planning over the next 6 months for that project.
Cool. Okay, so let's swing the conversation in a slightly different direction. And let's talk a little bit about sea monsters. What inspired you to include the sea monster within your work? Why sea monsters?
Because why not? Because I love monsters, because I love animals, and I like including animals in kind of larger than life versions of them in my work. Mm-hmm. I have another short story that I'm working on right now that has a massive spider in it. but I've always loved the idea of the Leviathan. I've always loved the story of the Kraken. There's just something about the depths and things coming out of the darkness. And yet in the same way, my Leviathan, I think, is also just doing its nature. It's performing its nature. So it's not necessarily an evil thing. It just is.
It's very interesting that you have Leviathan, because obviously Leviathan was also used in conjunction with royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about these themes of, you know, empowerment and tyranny and things along those lines. And actually, sea monsters are often, or monsters in general, but particularly sea monsters and particularly Leviathan, are very much linked in with that.
Yes, yes. I had read Hobbes in high school, and I have to go back to him as part of the novel project. And I think that was kind of simmering in the back of my head as well. These kind of concepts of power. And then, of course, also because the books are set in England, you know, there is that tie-in with English history as well, and the way England has conceived of its power. So all of that sort of came to play. And then it's also just fun to write giant, kind of quasi-Lovecraftian monsters that devour people and destroy ships and so on. So
yeah, it does actually come across as quite Lovecraftian. I thought that reading it. And you never feel it's really the antagonist, though. It's almost like the Leviathan's a manifestation of the ids of the real antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that was enjoyable as well.
Well, yeah, I think there's, and again, I mean, I should say that my spouse is British. And so I've had, and he's working class Northern British. And over the years, I've had a bit of insight into how that population thinks of England, the kind of the mixed take on Brexit that's been going on that I've been getting filtered through my in-laws.
Yeah.
All of that kind of came into play as well. I mean, I think the Mastersons have one real concept of England that doesn't necessarily include everyone in England. So,
yeah. And that's I'm just going to pry. Which part of the north is he from?
Manchester.
Oh, he's a Manchester boy. Right, yes. Got it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's really interesting. Because I was going to ask, why England? Are there any other reason that you've set? I mean, England is actually good, especially considering the themes that you're looking at. Are the history of our empire? The history of the general atrocities that we have committed and continue to commit is rather long. So I can definitely understand how you'd be inspired to sort of set these kinds of stories in England, considering the themes that you're writing. But was it an interest with England first, or was it an interest with these themes that drew you to England?
Well, I think there's the themes came first, but I think part of the England setting was just a better familiarity with it now. I've been married for 15 years or so. And then also because of the novel series moves all over Europe. So I had already done a fair bit of research into 18th century England. And so using that research again, it gave me some shortcuts to kind of writing out the first story, and then we just went from there. Recycling the research has, you know, affected a lot of story choices over the last couple of years. We've written a lot in 18th century France and Italy, and just, you know, it's all in my head right now. So
fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really cool.
Let's move over into sort of the mystery and suspense side of just historical fantasy in general, because really that's kind of a mashup of genres for a start.
Yes.
By historical fantasy, what I'm talking about at the moment is obviously it's mostly historical, but there's a fantasy element to it, or a speculative element.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then layering on the mystery on top of that, I mean, you see lots of books set in Victorian London. Victorian London is a favourite for people all over the world for some reason.
Yes.
Especially around Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
The number of supernatural retellings of Jack the Ripper are astronomical. I like a good ghost story, as Madeline will tell you.
Yeah, you do.
But it was interesting to see something in a late Georgian setting, really, because there are comparatively less books set in Georgian England. I think people think after the Regency that, you know, not an awful lot happened, but obviously lots of things happened.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to see mystery happening there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think the Georgian setting came out of an initial desire to kind of look at the Enlightenment and this kind of rubbing together of an older society and a newer, or at least an idea of a newer society. I was just fascinated by a time period where you could have people debating man's rights and reason and even things like atheism in a coffee shop. And then at the other end of London, you could be hanging a child for theft and trying to put those two things together, or watching, you know, slave ships leave the harbor as you're having this you know, dialogue at the same time.
Yeah.
And because it speaks to, I think, where we are now politically more than the Victorian period does. It lets me talk about things that are happening now in a way that the 19th century doesn't quite work for me. So, and then I like mystery. I like to, you know, give you something to discover as we go and let you follow along with the characters as it kind of unfolds for them. I write very cinematically. I'm in the character's point of view, seeing what they see and touching what they touch. And so mystery, I think, comes kind of instinctively as a sort of just unfolding of what's going to happen. And I never thought of myself initially as a mystery writer, but every story I write seems to at least go in that direction, perhaps just because of my process.
Oh, that's really interesting. And do you read many mystery books at all?
Yes. From youth, when I was little, I had a grandmother who loved Agatha Christie and bequeathed to me her mountain of Agatha Christies, which don't all hold up to the test of time. But when you're like 8 or 9 and you're bored at your grandmother's house, they go down like water, man. They just, woo, they pass the time really well. And
I got to ask, who's your favorite Agatha Christie detective?
I'm kind of. Oh, I don't even know if I should say this. I'm kind of partial to Poirot, even though I know he's a bit of a jerk.
Oh, no! Poirot is great! Yeah!
So it's just me that's on Miss Marple, then.
Yeah. But then, Jules, you've always got a thing for little old ladies who are poking their noses into stuff they shouldn't
that,
be.
That is true, to be fair. I really have.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yes, I was also a Sherlock Holmes fan as a child, so maybe I also just have a thing for kind of, you know, over-educated, overbearing men as well. I don't know. Haven't written one yet, but maybe that's in the works.
It is interesting, actually, because there is a trend, which I am starting to see, of historical fantasy with elements of mystery as well. Or in particular, there's a lot, I've found quite a fair bit of historical fiction, which when it is not based around political events, does actually include a mystery of some description. And you get that in Tudor England. Well, most predominantly you get it during the Renaissance period because there's the whole political malarkey, but there's also this general element of no one really knew what the hell was going on.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I read a book recently, which is The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry.
And it's on my TBR. I have not gotten down that far yet, but yes, it's in the stack
really
here.
Good. I mean, obviously that's the sort of late Victorian era when they're sort of at Lyme discovering fossils and things like that. It's not set there, it's set in the Fens. And you never really know whether the serpent's a real thing or not. I mean, if you look at the newspaper clippings from the time, it suggests that perhaps somebody had a pet alligator and released it into the river, and it just kept wandering up and eating sheep and things. But it also sort of ties into our legends of Sir Pellinore and the dragon. But, you know, dragon in the old sense of a verum rather than an actual dragon as we would see it with wings breathing fire.
Yeah.
It was just really interesting. Like, the entire motif of the serpent all the way through is kind of like a subconscious manifestation of the main character and her character arc, her development. Because she's incredibly inquisitive. Her abusive husband's just died.
Yeah.
And her way of putting herself back together is to really throw herself into this new naturalism. And she's very intelligent as well. She doesn't really want the emotional side of being human, not even being a woman, but being human. So accidentally falling in love with a married vicar was not on the cards. And it all gets quite emotionally complicated. And I suppose really what the book does ultimately is draws your attention to different kinds of love on various levels. I won't spoilify it because it's definitely worth reading. But
sounds wonderful.
That, that is just that fancy element of this serpentine thing coming out of the river and devouring sheep.
And I think when you start doing research, and research can be a real rabbit hole, but as you start to get into the nooks and crannies, that, you know, things like that pop up, and there, you know, there's a lot of little stories like that. Leviathan is at least somewhat based on a French invasion, or an attempted French invasion in the 1750s that some said was thwarted by a leviathan in the sea. This naturalist tried to use it as evidence of an actual, you know, sea creature existing. Although, you know, later on they pretty much decided it was just a very bad storm that drove the ships back. But, you know, these reports that of you know, horrible things coming out of the water and destroying the French ships, it was just enough material there. It's like, oh, I can work with that. I can make something out of that. So
I like that. I hadn't heard that story.
Yes, yes. I think it was around 1757 or so they tried to come over. So
I love the fact that actually there was during that period there was a bunch of very, very strong storms. Mm-hmm. And they were almost always blamed on something supernatural. It's like, oh, the ship sank. Must have been something supernatural. I'm like, no, it might have been because of the storm and sort of not that great sailing. That is entirely possible. It might have been, like the Mary Rose sank. And it's just like, yeah, because you put the cannon of things too low, so it just filled with water.
Right.
But they're like, no, it was the witches. No, it was a leviathan. And
so you don't think physics might be a thing, maybe?
Right.
Witchcraft! So, yeah. That's very, very cool.
One of our previous guests, Matthew Willis, obviously wrote his first fiction novel, Daedalus in the Deep, and mm-hmm. that's set around the changeover during the Victorian period from, you know, the age of sail to the steamers. And the Age of Sail ships were kind of decommissioned and sent off around the coast of Africa to ideally prevent slaver ships to get through. Mm-hmm. And one in particular, Daedalus, apparently had a sighting of a sea creature and then abandoned its orders and set off after this sea creature because the captain was after a bit of glory. It's fairly well documented incident. Whether they actually saw a sea creature, I don't know. But as you say, there are all these little bits and pieces in there, and he's done a really, really good take on it with that particular book. So
mm-hmm. And I think from a marketing professional standpoint, we will probably see more stories like that, because I think, you know, you're talking about the sheer number of Victorian books out there now, and I'd say there's also quite a few Tudor books out there now, and as people start to look for ways to separate out, you know, their work from the pack, they're going to start seeing more smaller mysteries, more kind of nooks and crannies of history. A lot of just the bigger political events, I think, have been really, those markets are saturated. They're just hard to sell in right now. So,
yeah, particularly as you say with Tudor and Victorian, I've noticed an upsurge in Viking mystery.
Ah, yeah.
That seems to be a new thing. And there's some quite good ones out there already. So, historical fantasy mystery. There's also the Blackthorn and Grimm series by Juliet Marillier. I'm a bit torn as to whether they qualify as mystery, because I got to the second and third books in that trilogy and I knew who'd done it before. I'd read like a chapter and a half.
Oh, no.
And okay, that is something I sometimes do with crime and mystery novels. I know who it is. but they kind of felt like it was more set up as a fairy tale rather than an actual mystery, as it were. The first one was pretty good. I mean, I still worked out what it was, but I can't tell. Is it just that I'm a nasty, cynical person, Madeline?
I wouldn't use those words exactly, but I do think that you have there are certain books which, he surprises me even now that I will get something off the bat. I'll be like, oh, yeah, that's really obvious what's going to happen. But I blew my brother's mind. He got really annoyed because he really wanted me to watch Fight Club with him. And then about like the few minutes in, and I immediately got the twist. And Jonathan just stared at me and he was just there like, no, just watch till the end. And then he watched it at the end. He said, how did you know? And I was there like, Well, it was actually pretty obvious. Like, I didn't realize that was meant to be a twist. It was super obvious. But then on the flip side, there have been moments where other people will get the twist and my mind will be utterly blown. And I think it literally is just about the way that you've processed the information, or even in the way that, yeah, you've read things. And if you're tired, you might miss one important clue, which otherwise would have tipped it off for you. So I don't think, how did you put it, Jules?
Nasty, suspicious person.
I just think that you're very good at analysing information.
That's the most flattering light you could have portrayed that in, I think. To be fair, I did the same thing with Fight Club, but with The Sixth Sense, I did not see that coming until literally when the room rolled
across the floor. Oh, I saw The Sixth Sense coming. I saw that one coming. So. But I was sitting at the theater and I was like, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to see how they do it. I'm not going to say anything.
It's when you work it out and you're absolutely dying to say something, but you don't.
It's like, it's a ghost. He's a ghost. He's a ghost. No. It is, I think, one of the hardest things to write a really good twist. Like, it is just almost impossible in this day and age. I don't know how people, when they do it, I'm just kind of in awe. Like, wow, you actually figure it out some way. Because, I mean, storytelling is such an old set of patterns, and we have so many stories around us all the time now, and trying to figure out a way to kind of break those patterns even for a moment, it's you know, it's kind of like winning the lottery when it happens.
It's the hard thing of the fact that you've got to make something familiar enough that people kind of feel comfortable with reading it, and they're drawn in, and it's about finding that balance of making sure you've actually given the information that the twist actually feels, you feel fulfilled by the twist.
Yes, not that it's just coming out of left field.
Yeah,
but,
like,
you know,
what the hell? We had no preparation for that. Whereas it's that truly amazing feel where you suddenly go, oh my God, I cannot believe I didn't see that. And it was just tiny, tiny things in this build-up. It's about finding the balance between that. And I think that actually, really the sign of a good twist is going to be one that actually several people saw it coming already, because that means that you have put that precursor down, so people have a chance to kind of absorb that information. And that doesn't mean that some people will figure it out first, but the sign of a really good, successful twist is if they figured it out, but they still feel satisfied when it all comes together.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think I think that's also just the sign of a very good plot. Lately, I've been really aware of people's endings and how many times there will be some element that the character only discovers in like the last chapter, which, you know, is the thing that pulls it together. But we had no idea through the whole book that this was a thing.
Yeah,
and it's really starting to leap out at me, you know, like, oh, they're doing it because of this reason that no one has mentioned for the previous 300 pages whatsoever. And it's, you know, I get that, you know, it's a surprise for the point of view character, and thus it's a surprise for us. But, you know, to telegraph that in some way, I think just makes it, you know, it makes it for the reader a more satisfying experience.
Yeah. It is that balance, isn't it, about surprising them, but surprising them with something they actually knew subconsciously without it being contrived.
Yeah. It's got to be a nice surprise.
Who said anything about nice?
You know what I mean. Yeah, Jules, I don't think you've ever done a nice surprise for me. Not in book-wise.
Therefore.
No, that is a lie. Jules has done nice surprises where I don't think she's actually going to let something happen, and then she will, and I just get, ooh. Oh.
I think I've done that too much now, and now you think I won't actually kill off people who I do intend to. So
no, don't you dare! I have hostages. I have hostages too.
This is the thing with, you know, one of your closest friends being your writing buddy, though. I mean,
oh yes, yes.
We can kill the ones we love.
So, suspense.
Mm.
We've sort of touched on that a little bit, but would you say, in your opinion, that creating suspense in a sort of historical fantasy setting is different to trying to create it in a contemporary setting?
No. But I also think I'm not very good at suspense. It's one of my weaker writing abilities. So I feel like I'm still learning about suspense. So for me, it's always a challenge, whatever the setting and whatever the time period. I kind of just try to write it and hope it works and get feedback and try to, you know, pump it up a little bit, but it's not an instinct for me.
Mm.
I think I for a while I was nearly an academic. I taught college and, in grad school, I took on board a little too much the idea that you really need to spell everything out. And so figuring out when to withhold and when to put in is something that I kind of constantly wrestle with in drafts.
Mm. Okay. Yes. I saw an interesting thing. Well, I've been watching this series, which I have mentioned previously in previous episodes, called Jane the Virgin. And the main character is a writer. And actually, at one point, they had an episode where the narrator was basically talking about how you build suspense based on, you know, writer's rules. And they did actually put it in a really coherent way, which I really genuinely liked. And one of the interesting things about the way to build suspense is that you create an environment where the audience knows something before everyone else does, before the characters do. So the audience know, hang on a second, something has gone wrong. So typically you see it in movies, you know, you see people having lovely lunchtime and then the camera will pan down and you'll see that there's, you know, a bomb underneath the table just sinking away, you know.
Mm.
Dee, dee. And so that's a way, basically. So the audience knows something. And the way it's often done is in books is that you have that element of foreshadowing. So I think a really good example for me of that element of foreshadowing was in A Court of Thorns and Roses. At the end, Amarantha basically makes that deal with Feyre that if she completes the tasks, Amarantha will release everybody, but she doesn't give a specific time. Mm. And it's really been drilled into us at this point that it's very, very specific. And so immediately we know, oh, Christ, she's not going to let them go. And it kind of built that suspense that even though we were watching Feyre go through all of these things, we knew that actually it was going to be in vain to a certain degree, that something else was going to have to happen. So the first thing is, yeah, allow your audience to know. And then you let one character know. And again, this is an interesting thing, is that obviously you have the whole riddle going on. I'll use the Court of Thorns and Roses again because it's a nice written version that I can sort of use as an example. You let one character know, but you don't let anyone else know. So you have this whole riddle going on. And you're in a situation where other people know what's going on, and they clearly know what's going on, but they are not able to tell the other character. There is a block. So the rules of suspense are tell the audience, then let one character know the situation, and have to get it across to someone else. And that really, really builds suspense. But then the funniest rule of suspense is that you get to the last bit, information comes out, and then you de-stress the situation in that, oh, you find the bomb, it gets thrown out of the window, or the bomb goes off and everyone dies, but it's fine. No, none of the main characters were in it.
That's quite a brutal way of putting it, but yes.
You know what I mean. But, you know, when that bomb goes off, it's no longer suspenseful because the suspense is leading up to that explosion. And once that explosion happens, actually, there's a release of tension because actually, that's it. It's done now.
Yeah.
No. So it is kind of interesting. No, it's just because we're talking about how we release the information. And yeah, I think a large part of suspense is actually not necessarily how we release the information, but who we release it to at different periods. Because actually slowly slipping it out can really build that suspense, especially if we know it's happening, it's coming, and there's nothing we can do to stop it.
Yeah. I think it can also work if you have more than one viewpoint character and you have them working at cross purposes.
Yeah.
So what character A wants is directly against what character B, your second POV character, wants. And they don't necessarily know that they're working at cross purposes to each other as well. And you just know there is going to be a massive conflict at some point.
Yeah. Or it's when you've got two friends and they're both actually, their alter egos are fighting with one another. They don't know.
That's very manga, but yes.
It's not, come on, it's really superhero as well. Let's not lie. It's a very typical superhero trope.
Are you thinking of Mysterious Lady, is it Mysterious Ladybug?
Oh, yeah, Miraculous Ladybug.
Miraculous Ladybug. Sorry, I wouldn't know about this if you hadn't told me. I still haven't watched any.
It's so cute. Yeah. So that is actually a really good example. But actually, if you look at comic books, so often you have that situation where, for instance, Clark Kent knows... I was about to call him Uther Pendragon. He doesn't know Uther Pendragon. He knows Luther. He knows Luther. And there's this, they build that suspense because Clark Kent obviously knows that he's Superman and this is Luther. But Luther doesn't immediately know that Clark Kent is Superman. And the same when you have Bruce Wayne in situations where obviously he knows he's Batman, but no one else knows he's Batman. And you build tension in that way because the audience knows and one character knows. What they did, a really funny one where Bruce Wayne gets kidnapped and they project over and says, "Batman, you better come here in like 1 hour's time or Bruce Wayne gets it." And of course, we all know, and Bruce Wayne knows, that's going to be quite difficult on account of the fact Bats is obviously Bruce Wayne. But you create that tension of how are we going to deal with the situation now? Because the rest of the world doesn't know. So is the truth going to come out?
Just listening to this, for me, I mean, one of the things I would, in my mind, that I'm doing is then separating out tension from suspense, which for me has always felt like a matter of stakes. You know, if somebody has like an alter ego or something, and the only thing that's kind of at stake is that they might meet cute or have a little fight or something like that. I mean, that feels to me like much less suspenseful. It's tension, but it's much less suspenseful than if there's a bomb involved and will the bomb go off or not. The little advice I've had about suspense is to kind of think of it in terms of a countdown, in a way, like a ticking bomb, like some kind of building of pace as well as stakes. And that creates takes it past just tension into something more anxiety producing, more page turning, thrilling. Will it happen? Won't it happen?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
And it's also,
I was just going to say, because you mentioned Batman, that's made me think of when you've got Batman and Catwoman who are basically kicking the crap out of each other because they're at cross purposes. And then you have Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle sort of like, oh yeah, maybe we'll go on a date. And neither of them. And it's funny and it's quite tongue in cheek. As you say, Ellis, it's upping the stakes, isn't it, each time? So that instead of it just being, oh, my secret identity's out there, what will I do? It's kind of like, my secret identity's out there and she's going to kill me now.
Right. That's always been one of my favorite pairings, by the way, is the Batwoman and the Batman Catwoman dating scenarios. I've always loved those.
Definitely. Well, believe it or not, we have been talking for about 45 minutes, so I think we should give you a chance to tell us, well, obviously, where can we get your books, and, you know, where can we find you online?
So my books are available at, you know, most online retailers, Amazon, Kobo, Nook, what have you. And online, my website is traversingz.com. But also, if you just Google L.S. Johnson, it will come up along with my Twitter and my Facebook page and so on.
And can you remind us what the titles of your books are, please?
Right. So I have, the first book I published was a collection called Vacui Magia, which was a finalist for the World Fantasy Award.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And it won the North Street Book Prize. And then my novellas are Harkworth Hall and now Leviathan.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
That's very, very cool.
And I highly recommend both of those, by the way. But if you're not going to say it, I am. Okay, well, it's been really great. Thank you so much for coming on the show with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was wonderful.
It'd be great if you would come back again sometime.
Anytime. Talk about writing all day long. So
brilliant. Wonderful. Now, before we say goodbye, it's just time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. So this week, it's over to Jules, who's going to be breaking the rules a little bit.
Yes, this isn't a speculative fiction recommendation, but it is such an amazing book that I just have to throw it at you anyway. It's The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, and it's by Taylor Jenkins Reid. And basically, it's set in the golden age of Hollywood, and it tracks the lifetime of Evelyn Hugo, obviously. And yes, she has seven husbands, but that's actually really not the most relevant part of it. This is a story of calculation and intrigue, which would be one of my favourite kinds. It's also the probably the best depiction of bisexuality I've ever read in a book. It's utterly amazing, so I recommend it for that alone, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's well worth reading. So there you go, listeners, you can add that to your TBR as well. And at the moment, Gareth is probably groaning because he has a Goodreads shelf called Books That Jules Is Making Me Read. which I don't think is meant as an insult, probably. Says I set homework. Anyway.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks again for our guest who came on. And we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.